Starting our fourth week on Samson, and we're going to go into the next section next week on Judges. We've been walking through the reality that God is always faithful. God always does what's good and right and perfect, and yet Judges also reveals to us that the problem in this situation is that we don't. So we're looking to see who God is. One of the key themes of the book of Judges is that everybody does what's right in their own eyes. So even though we go through this, we talk about these judges, we realize that we're not always going to find the biblical definition of how we should live, and instead we're going to be challenged in some different ways. Someone asked a great question last week because they kind of thought, well, judges, isn't that kind of like a judge the way that we would see it today? These judges really are more leaders. They're not judges who sit maybe in a courtroom. Instead, they're actually God-empowered leaders sent to deliver his people. At this point, God's people did not have a king. But the problem is we begin to see these men who are supposed to be leaders leading the nation, and more often they become like kings. Instead of living to serve, they seem to be living to be served. And more we see that situation. So as we come to Samson today, we're going to hit probably the most noteworthy or most familiar passage that many people, if you've grown up, have probably at some point heard about who Samson is. So let me just kind of toss that out real quick as a question. This is the story that most people have heard. It's a historical account. It's not some made-up story or illustration. This is history, and it's God-given history, and we're given insights into it. But what do you remember about Samson? What are a couple of things that kind of pop up in your mind when we talk about Samson? What do you associate it? And this is where you get to answer some questions. Samson has issues with lions, okay? But Samson also has issues with something else. Women, okay? Samson definitely has issues with women, all right? So lions and women. What else do we know about Samson? What else? What other things do you remember? He is definitely used to getting his own way. This guy would probably get underneath our skin a little bit, okay? Who else? Who else do I see over here? Someone else over here had a hand up. He can be persuaded by a nagging woman, okay? What? And that's going to really come in clearly today. So someone else might be better at getting their way than him. That can be surprising. Anything else? When we say Samson, whose name pops up in our brain? Delilah, okay. Don, what were you going to say? Yes. Samson is regarded, and when he's mentioned in there, is he a picture of not faith? He's a picture of a man of great faith, which should cause a little tension to rise up in us to wonder, wow, how can that possibly be true? What else? Anything else that you remember about Samson? He has long hair, and that factor is very important in the story. Why does he have the long hair? Right. And who chose the Nazirite vow for him, just from what we've seen in the last few weeks? Okay. And was it even just his mother? Remember that, okay, just to even go back to there, his parents helped live out what God called him to do, which we've kind of seen probably wasn't easy with his personality. This wasn't the kid who sits there and goes, oh, I love to follow the rules. This was definitely the strong-willed, defiant child growing up, you know, and so, but his mother really carried this out, helped him to live out that Nazirite vow. What did a Nazirite vow essentially say? Yeah. So it would be similar to someone fasting today. You know, there's some spiritual disciplines that we do, and this would be similar to that, where this was a lifelong vow to say, I won't touch a dead body, I won't drink anything from the vine, grape juice or alcohol, and I'm never going to cut my hair. Those are three parts, the symbols that say to God, God, I'm really serious about this. I'm really serious about my faith. Tim, did you have? That's true. People kind of look at you and think, hey, that guy, he's either he's trying out for a model or he's a Nazirite, right? So one or the other. So this is a very public thing, very public reality. Any other things that you remember? Okay, he was very strong, very strong. We're going to see that in the very outset of this passage today. So I want to kind of, that's a great point for us. Oh, okay, so he's a Jeopardy answer. Great, okay. So that's why we've spent these 4 weeks looking at Samson. So let's pick up here in chapter 16, and what I'd like to do today is be able to show you first a warning. The end, I want to sound a note of hope. In the middle, I want to just bring us a consideration that I don't think is very standard for most of us today. So those are really the three things that we want to try and accomplish as we go through the passage today. We're going to read parts of it, comment on parts of it, and then draw out some of those key things rather than reading the whole thing. So we'll start in chapter 16 of Judges, verses 1 through 4. And I'm going to comment on this in just a second here. Chapter 16, remember that in chapter 15, verse 20, we found out something that I think surprised me, was I forgot that Samson judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. So this was a long judgeship. It's easy to read this and think this took a week, but this was something that happened for 20 years. God said, I'm going to send Samson to be the person who begins to deliver Israel. So in chapter 16, verse 1, it says, Samson went to Gaza. Now, this is the capital city of Philistia. Okay, so this is the Philistine capital. This is where the strongest point. So Samson goes to Gaza, and now we're picturing, okay, here's this judge sent by God to deliver God's people, and he's going to go right to the capital. Man, I wonder what he's going to do there. But if we know Samson's story, we might have an idea about what he's going to do there, because there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. Kids, if you don't know what a prostitute is, you write that on your piece of paper, and then you can talk to your parents, because you know what? This is good for you to get to talk to your parents about these types of things, so you understand these concepts. Samson saw a prostitute, and he went into her. So the Gazites, the people from that town, were told that Samson has come. This is part of why I kind of wonder once in a while why he wasn't more noticeable. Remember, you don't get a picture on the news, so that probably made it a little harder to find out who he was. But you would think with the long dreadlocks, the seven long braids of hair, that he might have been noticeable. Whatever happens, they find out that Samson's come here. So they surround the place where he was at, and they set an ambush for him all night at the gate of the city. And they kept quiet all night, saying, let's wait till the light of the morning, and then we'll kill him. Not sure exactly why they decided to go with this route. My guess is it might have to do with the 1,000 people who were killed with the jawbone of a donkey. And they might have thought, I got a better chance during the daytime of seeing what's going on here. Or at least getting out of the room if I have to. What they do is they go to the gate of the city. And this whole army of fellows are there waiting to get Samson. But Samson lay till midnight, and at midnight he arose. So Samson is not opposed to leaving a woman in order to save his own skin. This is not a strong point. Rather than protect her, he protects himself. So at midnight he gets up, and then he does something that's pretty amazing. He took hold of the doors of the gate of the city. These are about, you know, probably 2 stories tall. There was this major kind of a tunnel that they would be incorporated into. That's how this whole army could sleep right there at the gates of the city. And he took hold of the doors of the gates of the city and the 2 posts on the sides, and he pulled them up, bar and all. And then he put them on his shoulders, and they carried him to the top of a hill that's in front of Hebron. So he took them towards Jerusalem. This is probably about 40 miles. So he has these steel gate bars, doors, huge, on his shoulders. Think if you've seen like the Lord of the Rings movies, the big gates that they went through when they went through those. He takes these things up, he lifts them up, puts them on his shoulders, and as a sign, essentially, when he rips those out, what does it do to the capital of this Philistine nation? It's totally vulnerable. They can't even close the front door. Can't even close the front door. And he, what he has done is he has shown, I have the power and the strength and the ability to kind of, you think you're going to come kill me, but instead I will rob from you. And he takes them all the way over towards the Jewish capital and sets them on a hill, kind of just out there. Can you imagine walking like that day? And all of a sudden you come on these huge gates just out in the middle of nowhere. It would cause people to wonder, what in the world happened here? Here we have this guy who, think back through his history as we've looked at it so far, what's happened every time. He instigates a problem. The Philistines, like we talked about last week, have to figure out how to solve the problem. They come up with an answer about, here's how we're going to solve the problem. We finally figured out what to do with Samson. Then, whenever they try to engage their plan, Samson rises up and destroys them. God's purpose is to take Israel from saying, wow, we love the Philistines and we feel so close to them and there are really good masters who help us, and begin to say, no, they're not your really good masters. Instead, you are slaves to them, and the only one that you should serve is me. That's not where their hearts are. So Samson has been just digging this up, churning this up. And every time he goes to engage these guys in battle, whether it's a pure motive or whether it's a negative motive, what have we seen? We've seen this one phrase, then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. You know what you're not going to find in chapter 16? That phrase. And it's going to be a big change. Because where did his strength come from? Yeah, it wasn't from Planet Fitness. Okay? It was from God. The Spirit of God would empower him to do exactly what he needed to do here. I just want to comment real briefly on the danger of success. Because so far in Samson, as we've read through his story, what do we see for Samson? Success. Just success after success. Everything he turns his hand to, you know, in a sense, turns out the way, you know, where he wins. He turns out he's powerful. I want to just remind us, adversity seems hard to us spiritually. When we go through pain, when we go through difficulty, when we feel weak, when we can't do these things, we think that that is really hard and bad for us. But let me just warn you, remind you that actually success is even harder on us. John Flavel, a Puritan minister, said this way, outward gains are ordinarily attended with inward losses. Have you ever felt that before? You succeed, and yet what happens inside your soul? You do well. You accomplish. One of the things we've learned even here is as we call men to preach, which is something that we do with regularity, we're learning how important it is to also warn them that after they have preached, to be ready, because sometimes that success can lead to inward loss and pain and difficulty. Flavel, to kind of sum up what he says, is he says inward gains give us these growth in humility, self-control, wisdom. Those things are ordinarily attached to outward losses. The times when our finances, our careers, or our relationships are failing. Samson's experiencing these outward wins. He's so successful. A lot of us want to be successful. We want to be known. We want to be prized. But in God's economy, so often, the times where we have our act together the most are the times where inwardly we fall the most. On the other hand, for those of us who feel like we struggle, we can't get it together, we see our weakness, we struggle with that. As we saw in the Sermon on the Mount, those are actually the places where we ought to be. So Tim Keller said this, in grace, God takes even our weaknesses and failures and uses them for us. But in sin, we take even his gifts and strengths and use them against him. Our sinful hearts find ways to use God's blessings to ruin our lives. Is that not a picture of Samson? All these things that God has given to him. So Samson falsely identifies God's blessing in his life. And what does he think to himself? I think when he rips these gates out, when he defeats essentially this army, leaves them looking like absolute fools, because what are they sleeping and guarding when they wake up in the morning? Nothing. When he rips this out, I think he literally thinks to himself, I can't be defeated. I can live as I want to. I am so successful that I will get God's blessing. I got this because I'm smart, because I'm savvy. I got to where I am today because I'm self-sufficient. If other people would just work as hard as I do, if other people were as intelligent as I am or self-applied, do you see the danger? There's a warning here. Let's pick up in verse 5. Verse 4. So he took them there. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. So this is why this is this famous passage. And the lords of the Philistines, so who would that be? These are the key rulers of the people. Okay? This is the president. She is being courted by the highest of the high in the land. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and they said to her, seduce him. See where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him, and we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and how you might be bound, that one could subdue you. Now, relational advice right now. Okay? If a conversation goes anywhere like this, get out. But when you think you're invincible, you don't get out. Right? When you think you're invincible, you don't get out. So Samson says to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and like any other man. Then the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. Now she had men lying in ambush in an inner chamber. Again, relational advice. If she has guys lying in wait in an inner chamber, get out, okay? So she had these men lying in ambush in an inner chamber. She said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it touches the fire, and the secret of his strength was not known. We're going to see that repeated, right? Verse 10 surprises me, because then it says, then Delilah said to Samson, behold, you've mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound. The fact that Samson's even there to have this conversation at this point, is this not pretty ridiculous? Why would Samson still be there? Why is he playing this incredibly dangerous game? Now, we see a lot about Delilah's motives, but the narrator doesn't tell us anything about Samson's motives, but we can guess that he was really motivated by this. He's overconfident in the face of danger. And in fact, maybe he's even become hooked on danger. Maybe there's something kind of life-giving for him about the fact that there's this game of cat and mouse with his own life. I don't know exactly what's going on. But I am saying, okay, you know, if you come to me in a counseling appointment and you say, well, this is what happened the other night, I'm going to say, get out! Okay? But Samson does not get out. Right? Samson does not get out. So let's continue on here. And Samson, you've mocked me, verse 10. tell me how you might be bound. So 11, he said to her, if they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, I shall become weak and be like any other man. So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. And then the men lying in ambush were in an inner chamber. But he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. Verse 13, Delilah said to Samson, until now you've mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you may be bound. So like Tim said, this guy is there's one thing that can pry under his armor, and it seems to be her repeated attempts. So he said to her, if you weave the seven locks of my head with the web and fasten it tight with the pin, then I shall become weak and like any other man. So while he slept, Delilah took the seven locks of his head and wove them into the web. So this is her weaving loom, right? This is a big wooden structure that she's weaving on. And she weaves his hair into it. So she made them tight with the pin, and then she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep, pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web. So he destroyed this whole thing. I think at this point she's starting to get angry because he just destroyed something of hers in the middle of all this. She doesn't care about destroying him, but I think she's going to get pretty upset now that he actually broke something of hers. So she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You've mocked me these three times, and you've not told me where your great strength lies. And when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. Remember last time when he was dying of thirst? God, how could you not save me? I just delivered all your people here, and now you've left me to die? This guy is prone to overstatement, but his soul was vexed to death. 17, and he told her all her heart, and he said to her, a razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. And when Delilah saw that he told her all of his heart, she sent and she called the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up again, for he has told me all of his heart. And then the lords of the Philistines came up to her. They brought the money in their hands, and she made him sleep on her knees. And she called a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. Catch this. She said, the Philistines, verse 20, are upon you, Samson. And he awoke from his sleep. And what did he say? I will go out as at other times and shake myself free. Did he not know his hair was gone? Very unlikely. He knew his hair was gone. That's why he said, I will go out like I've done other times. What didn't he know? What does it say? He didn't know that the Lord had left him. He didn't know that the Lord had left him. Just to finalize this out, verse 21. The Philistines seized him. They gouged out his eyes. They brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze shackles. And he ground at the mill in the prison. But the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. Let's take a look at this because there's an important warning here. Verse 20, he awoke from his sleep and he said, I will go out as at other times and shake myself free. But he didn't know that the Lord had left him. My sense is that he did not really believe that his hair or that Nazarite vow especially was really where his strength came from. He had really become to believe that his strength was simply his. Now, think about the Nazarite vow. Back when he first got married, he threw a party, which essentially is a drinking party. What's a Nazarite not supposed to drink? Alcohol or anything that comes from the vine, grape juice even. But he throws a really big drinking party. Knowing Samson's personality, do you think he really refrained during all that? How well do you think he was doing at keeping this Nazarite vow? What was the second thing that we saw in the Nazarite vow? It was this lion problem. You know, I know Sandy told me he's dealing with chipmunks right now. Chipmunks are a little easier to deal with than dealing with lions. So I'm glad the lions aren't in your garden eating things or people. Chipmunks are a little easier to deal with. But he touches this dead lion. He scoops, you know, honey out of this dead lion. So, yeah, I think in his head he thinks, you know what, this Nazirite thing really isn't much to do with this. It doesn't matter how I relate to God. In a sense, I'm unique. In a sense, he believes that the strength is simply his. No matter what he did or how he lives, he is not going to lose this strength. Samson didn't realize how dependent he was on God's mercy. Yeah. Right. I that's right on. Perfect. Thanks, Tom. That's it. I really think he's come to believe that God needs him. I also think that he feels like he has the right to call on God at any point, and God is somehow in his debt. It's like the genie. God, you owe me these wishes. We've talked about this. We've said, first thing when we look at a passage like this is not to immediately take it into our culture and say, what do I need to learn from this? But we do ask, well, what did God want them to learn from this? Why would little Israelite boys and Israelite girls read this story about this sinful, broken leader that they were supposed to identify with and understand? That's an important question for us. And hopefully you're beginning to see some of this, that he's beginning to see his strength as an inalienable right rather than a gift of God's mercy. I loved what Keller said on this one. He just said this. He said, you know what? He starts to treat this like it's some magic power. Not as a gift from God. So he goes on and defines this. He says, magic power depends on external conditions and their exact manipulations. If it's a love potion, and if a love potion requires 3 pinches of ground newt's eye, then 2 pinches won't do, will it? And when you get it right, the magic just happens. Magic is a matter of following the steps to the letter, which pushes a supernatural button, and the power comes automatically. Still quoting here. In fact, Samson had the same magical view of his strength, except he thought that the power came automatically regardless of rules. The Philistines thought he must do something to keep himself strong. Samson thought, I don't have to do anything to keep myself strong. But God's power, listen to this, is different. It depends on internal conditions, on a heart relationship. There's no divine power without discipleship. So Jesus sent his disciples out with power of the Holy Spirit in Acts 1:8. What is that power? It's the power of knowing that Jesus promised, I am with you, in Matthew 28:20. To be with someone is a Semitic phrase for relationship. And so what mattered was not so much that Samson's hair had been cut, but that the Lord had left him. Do you see the significance of this? It becomes important. That's why we had to read verse 22. Because I was taught in Sunday school growing up that his hair started to grow back. Samson's getting his power back. That's magic. What's the significant thing that happened here? A broken relationship with God. It's not rule following, thus I get God's approval and strength and help. It's a heart relationship. It's a heart knowing. It's a heart that's dependent on God that really does this. So our Christian duties, our spiritual strength, need to flow out of a relationship with God rather than being an attempt to get the favor and the blessing from God. Some people might say, hey, I don't go to these movies. I don't listen to this music. I don't talk like this. We don't see these things. We don't drink wine. We're Nazarites, except I keep my hair normal looking. You know, and we think, now God has to bless me. Parents, we can see this in our own lives because we look at our kids and say, what did I do wrong? I did this for them and this for them, and I sent them to this, and I took care of them here. And we think, what went wrong? How can this kid be struggling? It's about relationship with God. So that child needs to come into their own heart relationship with Jesus and dependence on Jesus. You may have done nothing wrong. But if I think that by sending my kids to this type of school, or if I think that by doing these things, I have changed my kids, I need to be very careful about that. If I look in my own life and I see, God, I follow the rules the way no one else does, I'm good and they're bad. There's a dangerous place in there. Is it out of love that I do what God commands because I trust Him, I believe Him, because I love Him? Or is it because, again, I'm trying to show Him that I am really good at this, I'm well behaved, thus, God, You should love me? Big change in there. So let's go back to that question I asked a minute ago. Why would Israel be told this story? Why Samson? Don't you ever wonder that? When you read through this, you go, God, why would You put Samson in here? Why does he get 4 chapters in this book? He just doesn't seem like the guy you really want to study. Why this expanded story about his selection and then birth and then being brought up, and we hear him constantly going after other lovers instead of after God? Huh, who does he seem like? Who would be a parable of? The nation of Israel. God wants little boys, little girls, dads and moms, He wants them to read this and say, that's who we've been. As vile, you know, as stomach-churning as it is, if that was our son, you can think about how painful that would be for you to see your son in these places. If that was your daughter, you could imagine what it would be like to say to them, why do you have to go and find, you know, a woman outside of our country? Why do you have to find somebody who's godless? Why can't you find somebody who loves God? And what God is doing here is He's saying, look, Israelites, I want you to see yourself. This is what you look like. You've been chosen. You've been blessed. You've been empowered. I brought you out of nowhere as if a barren woman who, you know, was wishing to be a mom. I created you as a nation you never existed before. And I didn't choose you because you were strong. I didn't choose you because you were beautiful. I didn't choose you because you were wise. I chose you because I loved you. And then I empowered you and strengthened you. But what has been the power of Israel? You know, what has been the direction of Israel's life? Throughout the book, we see that every single country that invades and conquers Israel, Israel gets conquered in the heart and loves and serves the gods of those that they've been invaded by. And God says that's like adultery. It's like skipping outside of your marriage. Samson is Israel. Now, it's a good thing we're not like that. Right? It's a good thing we don't have other loves or other things that we live for or find our significance in. It's a good thing that you know, we're not like that. And boy, good thing we learned from this early. Or did we? There is a challenge for us here. It's a word of warning. What does Samson do here? He thought, you know what? Whenever I call out to God, He has to respond to me. But what did God do here? he rejected. Israel needed to understand that there was a sense in which God is warning them, listen, if you continue on seeking after these other loves, living for them, giving yourself to them, there is a danger that you will be rejected. And it's a real danger. Yes, sir. Yep. Right. And that's what we're going to look at, right? Yeah. So he's, but what God is warning us to say, listen, be careful. Israel, don't take me for granted. Don't take my grace for granted. We can look at it ourselves today and apply it this way to say, listen, are there places, is there areas of sin where you sit there and go, you know what, God, you've got to accept me. I can love this, I can treasure this, I can pursue this sin, I can do what I want to do. God, what you have brought into my life is not fair, and I don't care. I know you say, don't do this, don't live, this is not helpful for you, this is not healthy for you, don't do this. And yet I can sit there and say, well, God, all I have to do is do it, and then I'll just repent later. I've had people in my office, and we've talked about these things. I'm just going to do what I want to do, and then after I get that done, I'll come back. There is a deep warning in this passage for us. I don't care how much of a Nazarite you see yourself to be. There is a place, just like Hebrews talks about, where we can make a shipwreck of our faith, where we can find out we never, ever really loved God or followed God. We weren't believers. Even if we had traveled to India and given away everything we had to the poor, and even if we had gone to Bible classes every day of our life and we've memorized all the Bible, and even if we've walked the aisle 16 times, there is a danger here. If I believe that God is like magic and that I just have to push buttons to get him to do what I want him to do, rather than dealing with deep heart relationship and love. God calls us to love him. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the way you'll know that you're doing that is what? You'll love your neighbor. If you don't love your neighbor, is there a possibility you don't love God? Yes. If there's not reconciliation, if there's not restitution, if there's not, you know, that, if that's not there. There's a warning in this passage. For good, main, Christian people. So the question is, what describes the nature of your relationship with God? Literally, for me, this week, there was a fear. There was this thought, oh God, please, please don't let me be like that. God, please don't let me ever think that this sin is okay. God, please don't let me get to this point to where I think I deserve this rather than that I am moved by this. Now, I know that there might be some people who say, oh, you shouldn't think that way. No, I absolutely should think this way. That is the proper response of faith. The proper response of faith says to God, please, please don't let me be there. And we turn to God and we ask for help. We say, God, please let me love you. Don't let me take for granted these things. If that's what wells up in your heart, you're probably headed the right direction. If what wells up in your heart is, yeah, so-and-so needs to hear this today, you may need to be careful. There's a warning. A consideration now. Consideration. Look at verses 23 through 27. There's a lot of story here. But now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. So they said, our God, has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands. Did Dagon give Samson in their hands? Was it his strength? No. What happened? It was because the Lord left him. That's why he's there. But what are they saying? When the people saw him, they brought him out, right? When they saw him, they praised their God. For they said, our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country, who has killed many of us. And when their hearts were merry, they said, call Samson that he may entertain us. So they are singing. They are worshiping. This is a worship service in this large temple. And here's this statue of Dagon in the middle. And they're going to bring Samson out here in just a moment. And then we find out that there's thousands more that are up on the roof of this place. So they called Samson out of the prison so he can entertain them. And they made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young men who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean on them. Now the house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. And on the roof there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. This is a massive group. So the entire infrastructure, governmental infrastructure of the Philistine people are there to celebrate their great victory over this one man. We as human beings tend to go towards the person, so we think, wow, poor Samson. He lost his eyes, he lost his dignity. Now he's having to be paraded around like a dog and pony show. And we might even get angry. But what is really going on here? Have you considered this? This is not so much a story right now about Samson and the Philistines as it is about God and Dagon. Right? I know in our Western world, this may be the very last thing that we think of. But what's happening here? God is going to vindicate his own honor. Now, Samson says it in a way that sounds like he's going to vindicate his own honor. But the bottom line statement here is that God is looking at this non-God named Dagon that they claim delivered them from Samson. And bottom line, Samson's shame has become Yahweh's shame. Because of the actions of Samson, God's name, God's reputation, God's glory has been sullied in a sense. And will God stand for that? He will not. My glory I will not share with another. So God goes to battle in this moment. The praise that belonged to God alone is being heaped at the feet of this helpless block of stone. We can't let the story of Samson's last efforts draw our eye away from what matters most. God will not share his glory with another. But we also have to admit, that doesn't bother us very often, does it? As a culture, as a people, I'm very bothered when your sin affects me. But let's just be honest. I don't know many people who are honestly walking around really upset about the glory of God being sullied. Do you? Is it natural in our hearts to think of the shame, the dishonor? Now, I may say that at times, but when I really look under the hood, too often I find out that what I'm really worried about is more my rights. So I invoke God's name because my rights have been trampled. We were made to live for the glory of God, to love the glory of God. Maybe we need to pray, God, would you give me a heart that's soft towards your name? God, would you give me a heart that honestly cares about your glory going forward? So that's a consideration for us. Let's just end up on this note of hope, though. So here we are in verses 28 through 31. Samson has been their prisoner. His hair has begun to grow back. He's drawn into this temple with thousands, maybe 10,000 Philistines that are in its place. All of their leadership structures are there. They're in the place of their great God who they worship and honor. Then Samson called out to the Lord. Only second time in the book that we find that phrase, right? Last time, he cried out for water because God failed him after he, you know, like Tom read to us, after I delivered this great, you know, after you used your servant to make this great win over the Philistines, God, now you're going to kill me because I don't have any water. And what did God do? God opened up water for him and let him drink. This time, Samson calls out to the Lord and he says, "Oh Lord, please, oh Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on one, his left hand on the other. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the Lord's and upon all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed during his life. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah, his father, and he had judged Israel 20 years. Here's a note of hope. Samson's hair growing back is not to make us think, ah, now he has hair. He's going to be strong again. Okay? And that's good for some of us who are follically challenged, right? Because it's not about hair. Because his strength doesn't rely on his hair, but rather, we got to understand that the Philistines are thinking, well, his hair is gone because he broke his vow. The magic is gone, so he's not going to be strong again. And What stands out here is broken Samson crying out to God. And when God answers him, it comes in the middle not only of desperate need like it did last time where he was so thirsty, but it also comes in the middle of miserable failure. This is the Samson. Here's a quote by Dale Ralph Davis. He says, "This is the Samson who would rather play around with Delilah than protect Yahweh's gifts. This is the Samson who faithlessly bartered away Yahweh's strength in order to court a treacherous lover. It is this Samson, faithless, foolish, fallen Samson, who Yahweh hears in this chapter." This is grace. The story of Samson also would speak to the Israelites to say, turn, repent. No matter where you've been, no matter who you are, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you've done, because listen, God is listening. Here is a man who does not deserve God to help him one bit. And yet, what is God's heart? Remember what God had said to the Israelites just before this? Right before we got to Samson? I will no longer save you anymore. Because of your faithlessness, because of the way you've acted, I will no longer save you anymore. But what does God do? Because of the compassion of his heart, because of his grace, he sends Samson. While there is this important warning for us, let us not walk away without seeing that this is a God who does not give to those who deserve. Instead, he gives what is good to those who do not deserve it. What should this do for us? No matter where you're at today, whether you would look at your life right now and say, you don't know the mess I'm in, and you don't know the mess I've made. you don't know what I did last night, or you don't know what I've accomplished. You don't know me. That's the person God responds to. Amen? Do you believe that? Look at the softness of God's heart. Here Samson seems to be fighting against him at every turn. God, he has hurt God's reputation. He has inflicted pain into the situation. Knowingly, purposefully, and uncaringly. And yet, what is God's response? Such great grace. Grace to actually let Samson go out as a hero. This is the faith part that Hebrews is talking about. This is why Hebrews talks about Samson as a man of great faith. Because in this moment, he has lost the pride. In this moment, he has lost all of the parts where he believes that he deserves this. And he cries out once more. And look, he doesn't even cry out to say, God, keep me safe in the middle of this. He says, just let me die with them. But let me deliver your people from this oppressive God. God, I can't stand to let them mock you anymore. This is faith. It's interesting because you find out that in the story of Judges, we see that God can deliver Israel with a whole army of willing volunteers, right? But then we show that in Gideon, God could actually deliver Israel with an army of just 300. But when God's spirit came upon Samson, Edmund Clowney says this, the Lord showed that he had no need for even 300. He could deliver by one. In short, we have in Samson, more than in any other judge, the pattern of victorious defeat. Rejected, beaten, chained, all alone, and finally dying under an avalanche of his enemies, Samson triumphed. Does that remind you of anybody else? Beaten, rejected, chained, all alone, at the hands of his enemies. Yeah. What was the difference between Jesus and Samson? Samson had all the power, but couldn't reign in his ego. Jesus came as a king to serve and not to be served, and to lay down his life as a ransom for others. Victorious defeat. And isn't that great news for us today? What Samson couldn't do, Jesus did. That's our hope. That grace, that help, that forgiveness, that's why we get here together. That's why it's only Jesus. All I need. It's all I need is Jesus. In the morning when I rise, what? Give me Jesus. Think through it. When I'm alone, give me Jesus. When I come to die, give me Jesus.